Do you want to do this? And that's Good afternoon, and welcome to this Newman Lecture. It's my pleasure to introduce our speaker this evening, Professor Graham McAleer. He was born and grew up in the north of England, and was educated at a lot of different places, actually. London, Canada, the U.S., and received his Doctor of Philosophy from the Catholic University of Louvain in Belgium, if I remember the location. Dr. McAleer is a professor of philosophy at Loyola University in Maryland. So he's part of our larger neighborhood. He's, as I said, a professor of philosophy, but he's specialized in a number of areas, particularly phenomenology, that is, as far as our talk this evening goes. He's the author of a number of books, one with the startling title of The Morality of Ecstasy and Sexual Politics. Go figure. But I've been told that it's really a very interesting and stimulating book, and that it sort of puts Professor McAleer on the kind of, shall we say, the philosophic map of young and interesting contributors. But I haven't read it. I probably should, but I'm a psychologist for my sins and not a philosopher for his. He's also recently published a book. That is, the other one was only a few years ago, but he's come out with a new one on To Kill Another. That's the title. Subtitle would be Homicide and Natural Law. So he has a nice broad spectrum of philosophic topics, and this evening he's going to speak to us about really the philosophy of hope, and I think primarily from something of a personalist and phenomenological perspective, but as I stand quite possibly corrected. So, without any more comment, I introduce to you Dr. Graham McAleer, and I think we're in for a real treat. Thank you.
I'd like to thank the Institute for inviting me here today. I know people like Roger Scruton have studied here in the past, and so it's a great honor to follow in those kind of footsteps. But yeah, you stand corrected in the sense in which, although I am a phenomenologist, I'm not going to speak very much about phenomenology today, although by all means, if we want to talk about that later in the questions, that's great. But actually, the paper is kind of built around developmental psychology and Pope Francis. So I am the director of our Catholic Studies, Catholic Social Thought program at Loyola. And Francis, of course, is, I think, proving quite controversial in some ways in Catholic circles, and in some ways kind of hard to understand. So I thought what I'd like to do is talk about his most recent document, The Joy of the Gospel, which is about hope, but he's got a kind of a very unusual idea about this, I think, and try to think about how to make sense of it, frankly, right? Because I think it's not transparently obvious how it works, those ideas. So this is called The Phenomena of Hope, Reflections from Catholic Social Thought of Developmental Psychology. Here is a quote from Pope Francis. "The individualism of our postmodern and globalized era favors a lifestyle which weakens the development and stability of personal relationships and distorts family bonds. What do people hope for? The world over, it is the same. A home with family fed, healthy and competent, and friendship amongst the generations. Belonging, a place that requires work but also gives membership, a rich identity with those belonging dressed decoratively in the markers of that membership, and a relationship with the divine. Globally, people participate in stylized rituals in honor of their gods, some in hope of continuity for the community, others in hope of personal continuity. Let's begin with what might seem an odd question. Is hope still relevant in today's world? For Pope Francis, the answer is emphatically yes. Shortly before Christmas, Francis issued his apostolic exhortation, The Joy of the Gospel, and caused a stir with his talk of the tyranny of markets. Much quoted by the press were his words, "Today we have to say, thou shalt not to an economy of exclusion and inequality, such an economy kills," end quote. The press could also have cited, "The worship of the ancient golden calf has returned in a new and ruthless guise in the idolatry of money and the dictatorship of an impersonal economy lacking a truly human purpose," end quote. Hope for Francis is a call to cleanse the economy. Quote, "An evil embedded in the structures of a society has a constant potential for disintegration and death. It is evil crystallized in unjust social structures which cannot be the basis of hope for a better future." Reaction to his words was swift. Leftists celebrated a pope no longer bothered about gay marriage, but outraged by poverty, and rightists lamented a pope seemingly giving up on the culture wars. Others, Catholics in the higher reaches of the American media, Peggy Noonan at the Wall Street Journal, Russ Douthat at the New York Times, insisted nothing new to see here. They argued that if the media really cared about what the popes say, they'd know the popes have been saying things like this for years, arguing that Francis is following the standard papal, European, social democratic line. Peggy Noonan pointedly asked, "I've never heard a pope worry about the depressive effects of high tax rates, have you?" There was another reaction. Some perceived an economic analysis released by J.P. Morgan at the time of the apostolic exhortation as a rebuke of the Pope. Unconcerned with the Pope's ideological coin, the J.P. Morgan document argues that the Pope is factually wrong. Today's economy is not one of exclusion, inequality, and murder. And surely the bankers have a point. Just how prevalent can poverty be when the Wall Street Journal is running a series of articles on global gluttony with titles like, "As World's Kids Get Fatter, Doctors Turn to the Knife"? Paul Collier, director of the Center for the Study of African Economies at Oxford University, author of the highly regarded The Bottom Billion, argues that all countries participating in the global economy benefit, the exceptions being those countries mired in war, perverse government, or landlocked with crippled infrastructure on account of the previous two reasons. Amongst hundreds of examples, in the decades since Bangladesh attracted the manufacturing business of the fast fashion houses, GDP in that country has doubled in 10 years. In my opinion, the J.P. Morgan argument cuts deeply, largely because of the power it draws from the 18th century Scottish thinker David Hume. A flourishing commercial life depends upon a sophisticated use of the mechanical and liberal arts. Hume makes his point magnificently, quote, "The more these refined arts advance, the more sociable men become. They flock into cities, love to receive and communicate knowledge, to show their wit or their breeding, their taste in conversation or living, in clothes or furniture. Curiosity allures the wise, vanity the foolish, and pleasure both. Commerce creates a humane civilization and defeats poverty because all go to the city to show off their strenuous efforts towards refinement. We crave being seen in the right, elegant light, and for that we need the ornaments gained through economic striving." Hume's formula seems to work every time. In a January article in the Wall Street Journal, Bill and Melinda Gates have this to say, quote, "In our lifetimes, the global picture of poverty has been completely redrawn. Here is our prediction. By 2035, there will be almost no poor countries left in the world. Yes, a few unhappy countries will be held back by war, political realities, such as North Korea, or geography, such as landlocked states in Central Africa." What I'd like to do now is show you a video clip from a famous statistician, a man called Hans Rosling. He is on Time Magazine's 100 Most Important People on the Planet, and you'll see that he's going to make the argument of Bill and Melinda Gates, the argument of David Hume, the argument of J.P. Morgan.
I teach global health, and I know having the data is not enough. I have to show it in ways people both enjoy and understand. Now, I'm going to try something I've never done before, animating the data in real space, with a bit of technical assistance from the crew. So, here we go. First, an axis for health. Life expectancy, from 25 years to 75 years. And down here, an axis for wealth, income per person, $400,000, $4,000, and $40,000. So down here is poor and sick, and up here is rich and healthy. Now, I'm going to show you the world 200 years ago in 1810. Here come all the countries. Europe brown, Asia red, Middle East green, Africa south of Sahara blue, and the Americas yellow. And the size of the country bubbles show the size of the population. And in 1810, it was pretty crowded down there, wasn't it? All countries were sick and poor. Life expectancy were below 40 in all countries. And only the UK and the Netherlands were slightly better off, but not much. And now, why start the world? The Industrial Revolution makes countries in Europe and elsewhere move away from the rest. But the colonized countries in Asia and Africa, they are stuck down there. And eventually, the Western countries get healthier and healthier. And now, we slow down to show the impact of the First World War and the Spanish flu epidemic. What a catastrophe! And now I speed up through the 1920s and the 1930s. And in spite of the Great Depression, Western countries forge on towards greater wealth and health. Japan and some others try to follow, but most countries stay down here. Now, after the tragedies of the Second World War, we stop a bit to look at the world in 1948. 1948 was a great year. The war was over, Sweden topped the medal table at the Winter Olympics, and I was born. Between the countries of the world was wider than ever. United States was in the front, Japan was catching up, Brazil was way behind, Iran was getting a little richer from oil, but still in short lives. And the Asian giants, China, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Indonesia, they were still poor and sick down here. But look what is about to happen. Here we go again. In my lifetime, former colonies gained independence, and then finally they started to get healthier and healthier and healthier. And in the 1970s, then countries in Asia and Latin America started to catch up with the Western countries. They became the emerging economies. Some in Africa follows, Some Africans were stuck in civil war and others hit by HIV. And now we can see the world today in the most up-to-date statistics. Most people today live in the middle. But there are huge differences at the same time between the best of countries and the worst of countries. And there are also huge inequalities within countries. These bubbles show country averages, but I can split them. Take China, I can split it into provinces. There goes Shanghai. It has the same wealth and health as Italy today. And there is the poor inland province Guizhou. It is like Pakistan. And if I split it further, the rural parts are like Ghana in Africa. And yet, despite the enormous disparities today, we have seen 200 years of remarkable progress. That huge historical gap between the West and the rest is now closing. We have become an entirely new converging world. And I see a clear trend into the future with aid, trade, green technology and peace. It's fully possible that everyone can make it to the healthy, wealthy corner. Well, what you just seen in the last few minutes is a story of 200 countries shown over 200 years and beyond. It involves plotting of 120,000 numbers. Pretty neat, huh?
So I think what you see there is a visualization of David Hume's argument. Alive today, Hume would say to Pope Francis that he has already delivered on the hope of a world with little poverty. There is now no more room for hope. The problem it responds to is solved. For Hume, the city means we are more beautiful in the aggregate than ever before. Darwinism confirms this. Healthier, more hygienic, engaged in a more complex work, better dressed and more ornamental. Of course, some individual lives may still be psychologically fraught, but in the aggregate, Hume will insist, the problem posed by hope is solved. Now let us enjoy our cities and entertain one another. Has business banished the biblical principalities of darkness? Is Pope Francis oddly out of touch? About cities, Francis says, quote, "New cultures are constantly being born in these vast new expanses where Christians are no longer the customary interpreters or generators of meaning. Instead, they themselves take from these cultures new languages, symbols, messages, and paradigms which propose new approaches to life, approaches often in contrast with the gospel. A completely new culture has come to life and continues to grow in the cities. What is this psychology birthed with this completely new culture of the city? In a moment, we shall turn to the clues developmental psychology can give us. Little noticed is the fact that out of Francis's 200 footnotes, more than 20 are to the works of Benedict, and an astonishing 50 are to the works of John Paul the Great. Benedict's profound love of cats and fluffy kittens earned him no purchase with the media. But surely it is no part of the media script for the popular Francis to be looking back to the chastising figure of John Paul II. All remember St. John Paul, he'll be canonized in a few moments, weeks, as a cultural warrior, a pope seldom not talking about abortion and euthanasia as profound corruptions of civilization, engines of, in his famous phrase, the culture of death. In his 1995 encyclical Evangelium Vitae, he also speaks of tyranny, about those states in the West that have legalized the systematic killing of the strong by the weak. Sorry, the weak by the strong. The ends, I was channeling Thomas Hobbes for a second there, right? Sorry, it's the other way, right? Strong systematically killing the weak. The encyclical argues that the strong have clubbed together in a conspiracy against the marginal, with respect to the weak, unprotected, and disabled, state law in Western countries retorts with Cain, "Am I my brother's keeper?" Francis can say our economy kills because the popes have long held that at the heart of modern commercial life is killing. In the wake of the financial freeze of 2008, Benedict returned to the theme of Cain, to the problem of indifference and brutal self-assertion. His encyclical Caritas in Veritate offers a brilliant formulation of the problem. Quote, "One of the deepest forms of poverty a person can experience is isolation. If we look closely at other kinds of poverty, including material forms, we see that they are born from isolation, from not being loved, or from difficulties in being able to love. Man is alienated when he is alone." The last three popes, therefore, have a common teaching. Isolation from others, lack of solidarity, creates a destructive and oftentimes murderous poverty. What is the exact character of this poverty? Perhaps we can accurately state the argument of Francis this way. The contemporary economy creates widespread vulnerabilities. It puts in jeopardy psychological development by fracturing families and isolating many by their very labour. It unhinges us from the myriad civic relationships that foster human development. In moral theology, hope is a species of courage, a response to fear. Hope aims to transform our fear, to change our anxiety into freedom, so that throughout the lifespan we make positive adjustments in matters of sexuality, childbearing, parenthood, career, civic and religious participation, and when dying too. The contemporary economy mangles the conditions required for these psychological adjustments. Hope demands an overhauling of the economy, therefore. Why? Despite the undeniable gains since Hume, is isolation endemic? Hume himself gives the hint. In commercial life, people flock to the cities to show off, so that others see their wit and breeding, their taste in furniture and clothes. The darkness to which hope responds is at the heart of the Humean city, its very engine, vanity. Thomas Aquinas, in his magisterial work on moral psychology, De Malo, 1272, identifies the deep structure of vanity as the desire to make manifest one's superiority over others, or, at the very least, never to be seen as inferior to others. Aquinas argues that vanity has a double structure. It boasts so as to vaunt the self over others and simultaneously works to diminish other people in the eyes of their neighbours. Interestingly, Immanuel Kant calls this phenomenon fashion. Why is vanity a deadly sin? Let's meet Patrick Bateman. This is a clip from the movie American Psycho. Is one of the great openings in American cinema.
I live in the American Gardens building on West 81st Street, on the 11th floor. My name is Patrick Bateman. I'm 27 years old. I believe in taking care of myself, in a balanced diet, and a rigorous exercise routine. In the morning, if my face is a little puffy, I'll put on an ice pack while doing my stomach crunches. I can do 1,000 now. Gel cleanser, then a honey almond body scrub, now my face an exfoliating gel scrub. facial mask, which I leave on for 10 minutes while I prepare the rest of my routine. I always use an aftershave lotion with little or no alcohol, because alcohol dries your face out and makes you look older. Then moisturizer, then an anti-aging eye balm, followed by final moisturizing protective lotion. There is an idea of a Patrick Bateman, some kind of abstraction, that there is no real me, only an entity, something illusory. And though I can hide my cold gaze, and you can shake my hand and feel flesh gripping yours, and maybe you can even sense our lifestyles are probably comparable, I simply am not there.
Francis writes, quote, "The culture of prosperity deadens us. We are thrilled if the market, in this case the beauty industry, offers us something new to purchase," end quote. Patrick Bateman is meant to be you and me. Each of us is, the film contends, because submerged in America's commercial life, compulsively vain and murderous. So, of course, Patrick Bateman is, as well as being this sort of beautiful man, he's a serial killer. Vanity existed long before commercial societies, but the glamour of commercial life, the luxury made possible by it, intensifies the spell of vanity. As Francis observes, our technologies encourage us to rush to isolation. We vaunt ourselves above others, but trigger an abandonment of our own selves in seeking so desperately the approval of others in the city. A double isolation from others and self is the consequence. Francis quotes Cardinal Newman on civilizations turning into deserts, deserts where the indifference of Cain prevails. Francis's opening sentences speak of a desolation wrought by consumerism. Not all agree. The well-known psychologist Jeffrey Jensen Arnett welcomes globalization. It allows the young to make their own choices about love, work, and personal values as traditional ways of life wither, a point predicted by Adam Smith in 1759. Arnett documents the negative reaction of elders in China and Japan to the youth becoming increasingly individualistic. Japan even has a harsh label for such, parasite singles. The allurements of the best jobs make the young postpone adult roles. In every industrialized society, Arnett observes, young adults transition into adult roles in their mid to late 20s. For example, in America today, the average age for marriage is 28, and for parenthood, 26. In 1970, it was 21. That some developmental psychologists welcome globalization's postponement of adult roles is highly significant, for Francis requires priests to pay close attention to developmental psychology. Quote, "Priests need to accompany with mercy and patience the eventual stages of personal growth as these progressively occur," end quote. However, Arnett's point is that these eventual stages are fluid, susceptible to significant change in light of large social movements like urbanization. It is unsurprising that a study conducted in 5 countries, the US, Nigeria, Peru, Pakistan, and Mexico, shows that in 3 out of the 5, the US, Peru, and Mexico, women give continuing with school, the demands of work, and the rigors of the daily schedule as the main reasons for having an abortion. And the study found that in all countries, economic reasons prompted abortions and subsequent internalized dissonance with keenly held beliefs. In a review article of extant psychological literature on why women have abortions, Maggie Kirkman found that studies consistently show between 40 to 50% of women report finances as determinative. Kirkman points to research by Finner, who identifies three leading reasons for abortion: interference with education, work, and care of dependents, 74% of respondents, financial constraints, 73% of respondents, and not wanting to be a single mother, 48%. It is estimated that the opportunity costs for an American woman taken off her career path due to an unplanned pregnancy can be as high as $1 million in lost salary. And these costs are a predictor of who will have an abortion. And who can doubt that the reasons happy with our family size, having children already of both genders, relate significantly to vanity and purchasing power? Depressingly, amongst young Catholic women students, religious affiliation is no impediment to getting an abortion, and those living in wealthier households are more likely to do so than those living in less affluent homes. Indeed, research shows that once desired educational levels are attained, then Catholic moral norms do correlate with the behaviors of Catholic women respecting abortion. Vanity usurps normativity. It is also not surprising, therefore, for Francis to say, quote, "In many countries, globalization has meant a hastened deterioration of their own cultural roots and the invasion of ways of thinking and acting proper to other cultures which are economically advanced," David Hume, "but ethically debilitated," end quote. The delay and rupture of family life for the sake of career leaves some individuals overwhelmed, lonely, and dissatisfied, psychologists have observed. Childlessness is increasing throughout all strata of American society, and the childless report loneliness on account of their friends breaking off when they have children. The loss of prestige for married family life can result in isolation too dark to be commonly discussed. Evolutionary psychology believes it has a handy explanation for why children are more at risk by being killed by their stepfathers than by their natural fathers. The Atlantic Monthly reports body image and isolation stalk certain children. Quote, "No non-poor children living with married step-parents have a 67% higher risk of obesity compared to similar non-poor children raised by married biological parents." Psychology is alert to these varied alienations, therefore. Whilst many valorize individualism and self-determination, autonomy, thinks Aquinas, oftentimes legitimates a vaunting of the self, and so Catholic social thought insists that autonomy has, quote, "an inherently relational dimension. Without a solidaristic relatedness, darker motivations prevail, and society becomes, quote, a mass of individuals placed side by side, but without any mutual bonds. The consequence of the rupture in relatedness can be severe. Some studies show suicide is more common in women who have abortions, with a Finnish study showing a doubling of the risk of suicide and an increased risk of exposure to violent death. Furthermore, a Swedish study looking into power relations surrounding abortion argues that teenagers certainly don't experience having an abortion as their own choice, but find themselves pushed around by partners, parents, medical staff, and schools. Aware of the Humean city, but demurring, Francis writes, quote, "Cities create a sort of permanent ambivalence because while they offer their residents countless possibilities, they also present many people with any number of obstacles to the full development of their lives. This contrast causes painful suffering," end quote. echoing these isolations in that part of the lifespan concerned with fertility, sexuality, marriage and family is loneliness at the end of life. Francis speaks, quote, of the abandonment of the elderly and the infirm in the city, end quote. A study by Balber found that the loneliness of the dying and disabled stems from the contrast of their immobility and slowness with the pace of modern life, its productive and competitive ethos. Francis comments, quote, in the prevailing culture, priority is given to the outward, the immediate, the visible, the quick, the superficial, and the provisional, end quote. A study by Block and Billings concludes that many requesting an end to life are actually looking for aid and company in living out their final days. This is complicated by the fact that a commonly expressed wish of those in palliative care is mending broken relationships and reconciling with estranged family. Psychological studies show that a majority of patients would like to spend their last days in their homes instead of in a hospital setting, and show that caregivers of loved ones who die connected to ventilators in a high-tech setting are 3 times more likely to suffer major depression 6 months after the passing. A New Zealand study looks at reasons why some healthy seniors support euthanasia. Much has to do with their experience of what they witnessed when the family members were previously sick. Many expressed disgust at the use of medical treatments they had seen and the resulting quality of life of their loved ones. Expressing their fears, suffering, of course, ranked prominently, but so too did a perception of loneliness and being a burden. Palliative research shows that the experience of pain diminishes when the elderly believe they are the object of care and concern. However, the tempo of dying contrasts significantly with the obsessions of the ordinary world, and one can only imagine these psychological experiences exacerbated if public policy discussions openly consider killing the sick for the sake of the nation's financial health, and such conversations are already happening. Conclusion. Developmental psychology helps confirm Pope Francis's polemic against Hume. Certainly, we are healthier, wealthier, cleaner, prettier than when Hume first found us. But significant dislocations brought about by commerce have not merely generated unhappiness, but fostered killings of the weak. Some argue that the sum total of homicides have decreased these last 200 years, notably the work by Pinkers. But the killing of the defenseless is in full flow. Each year around 43 million globally. Vanity excludes, and vanity is deadly. This is an unbroken teaching of the Church from Gregory the Great through Aquinas to Pope Francis. Vanity and its social form, the city, have pushed multiple moments along the lifespan and the slowness of disability and sickness into harrowing conditions. I believe Max Scheler's, an early phenomenologist, idea of the estate is a better social form than the city. Hope demands we ever seek solidarity with the poor, the isolated and the vulnerable, for such hope is basic to what it means to belong to this world that Christ took unto himself. If I can just conclude by showing a clip from an Italian fashion designer, a man called Brunello Cucinelli. And this, I think, is an example of Max Scheler's idea of the estate, and I can talk more about that later. But the main thing is, if you follow the... He's going to speak in Italian. If you follow the subtitles, you'll hear him talking about his father's experience of the city. And thus, when Brunello Cucinelli, who's a self-made man, created his own company, you'll see, what he's talking about, and it's really very beautiful, I think.
Ho sempre avuto un grande sogno nella mia vita, che è quello di rendere il lavoro dell'uomo più umano, sapendo che il lavoro è.
Yeah, good.
Ho immaginato quindi un'impresa che facesse profitti, sì, senza dubbio, ma facesse con etica, dignità e morale.
Nella verde terra d'Umbria, a due passi da Perugia, esiste un posto speciale. È un piccolo borgo, riportato alla vita nel nome di grandi ideali. Si chiama Solomeo, ed è il luogo che Brunello Cucinelli ha scelto per mettere in scena il suo mondo.
Della mia infanzia ho bei ricordi. Vivevamo in campagna, lavoravamo la terra, poi ci siamo trasferiti in città dove mio papà è andato a lavorare in fabbrica e spesso venivo offeso e umiliato. Io lì mi sono detto, ciò che farò nella vita vorrei farlo per la dignità dell'essere umano. Verso i 20 anni ho incontrato questo grande filosofo, Kant, e c'è stata una grande espressione che per me è stata molto importante. Due cose mi emozionano nella vita: il cielo stellato sopra di me e la legge morale dentro di me. Questi sono stati fondamentali su cui ho costruito la mia vita. I miei padri ispiratori mi hanno convinto di sentirmi custode e non proprietario di ciò che ho. Mi sono ispirato nell'impresa a San Benedetto, quando raccomanda all'abate di essere rigoroso e dolce, esigente maestro, amabile padre. Chiudiamo in un prodotto di grande qualità, di grande artigianalità e speriamo anche di creatività. Per realizzare questo abbiamo bisogno di quelle mani sapienti, di quegli esseri umani che quotidianamente vengono al lavoro con la loro dignità, con la loro tolleranza, con la loro umanità.
Brunello Cucinelli ha creato molto più di un'azienda di successo. Questo perché crede in un nuovo modo di fare impresa, che affonda le radici nella sua storia personale, si alimenta delle parole dei grandi maestri e si protende verso un futuro che va ben oltre il semplice profitto.
Conservare, abbellire, restaurare questo piccolo borgo, abbiamo spesso ascoltato la parola dei nostri grandi sapienti, i quali ci hanno educato ad ascoltare il genius loci, lo spirito dei luoghi. E quindi ci siamo rifatti all'imperatore Adriano quando dice: ci sentiamo responsabili delle bellezze del mondo. Ho sempre amato la vita nel piccolo borgo, questo per tanti secoli è stato produttore di olio, grano e vino e adesso è produttore di cashmere. Qui ci siamo rifatti a quella bella espressione di Jean-Jacques Rousseau: le città sono difficili da vivere, dobbiamo tornare nei borghi, ridiscutere e riprogettare l'umanità.
A fianco delle antiche mura di Solomeo, che ospitano uffici e laboratori, oggi sorge il Foro delle Arti, composto dall'Accademia Neo-Umanistica, dall'Anfiteatro, dal Giardino dei Filosofi e dal Teatro. È il sogno di Brunello Cucinelli diventato realtà, sotto forma di pietre, capriate, colonne e poltrone. È un pezzo di bellezza che ha lasciato in dono all'umanità.
Noi crediamo che l'impresa debba avere progetti a 3 a 5 anni, ma anche a 5 secoli. In questo caso il teatro rappresenta per noi un progetto a 5 secoli e in qualche maniera lo vorremmo considerare un tempio laico dell'arte. L'umanità sta andando verso una forma di nuovo umanesimo, dove illuminismo e romanticismo per la prima volta si devono incontrare, dove cioè mente e anima devono convivere. Quindi sono abbastanza convinto che questo possa essere il secolo d'oro. E a tal proposito vorrei ricordare una meravigliosa espressione del mio maestro Boezio: o beato genere umano, se i vostri animi fossero governati da quell'amor che governa il cielo.
Thank you. Well, that's it. Thank you. have time for questions? Oh, okay.
Value that we have in our society of independence, and how it's almost considered vulnerable and weak to need the other. And I've come to think of it from time I've spent in a really poor town in Mexico, where the poverty is so great that people basically, there's no illusion that they don't need each other. Mm-hmm. And they also know they need God. So there's that community aspect and the religious aspect that, you know, they bring into their lives, and I was wondering how that played in with the vanity, possibly the pride.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, I have three teenage daughters, okay, and you know, you could, you know, so I think every family in the modern Humean, right? So my basic claim is, right, that we live in a world significantly created by David Hume and Adam Smith. And you can walk into my house, I'll be at my computer screen, my wife, she's a lawyer, she will be, and my three daughters will be, right? Because now pretty much everyone watches TV on computers, right? So as Francis says, this rush to isolation, right, is very, very profound. And I think, I can talk about my own students at Loyola, although the college has not yet come up with a formal policy, the professors have sort of banned computers from the classroom. Cell phones must be kept in bags at all times. Right? If you look at your cell phone in class, you lose a full letter grade on one of your exams. Okay, and the reason is, right, because what we know, yeah, top of Loyola, the Jesuits are top. Right, because we know that these things are addictive, right? So, you know, people have done studies about this, right? It's the same phenomenon as pulling the handle of a slot machine, right? You always think the next time you look, something new will have happened, right? So the fascination with the new, right, which of course is central to the idea. Aquinas says the leading attribute of vanity is fascination with the new, right? And thus the city is, of course, the place where the new comes to reside, right? As opposed to what Cuccinelli suggests about the village, right? With its traditions, as he says, in my business, I plan for 5 years and for 500 years, right? So, I think the other thing, right, that Aquinas brings that's absolutely brilliant about this is the way that vanity works not merely as an assertion of the self, but actually also as a belittling of the other, right? So either one appears superior, or if you can't be superior, well, you can at least bring your superiors down, right? So this relates, of course, then to the problem of authority. And so autonomy is, of course, a fundamental challenge to the idea of an authority, of something that compels your obedience, that Aquinas says at one point, one of the fundamental features of vanity is contention, the idea that in an argument you must have the last word. So I think these themes of autonomy, now of course we don't want to throw out ideas of liberty, and, right, but we have to link our freedom inside an idea of community, and then the big question is, right, does our psychological adjustments, do they work best in the Humean city or something like this idea of the estate, right? So, yeah.
I'm trying to conceptualize what you're saying. So, on the one hand, we are moving toward an eradication of material poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, we have found a new form of existential poverty. And yet, Catholic social teaching says that we should work toward the eradication of material poverty because the material needs that we have often override our existential. And so if you're completely destitute, completely poor, then it's hard to then move to higher.
Right. So, you know, so Francis says in this text, right, that the future of the church is the poor. The problem that he faces in saying this is that there are people like David Hume or Hans Rosling, right, who's saying, well, what poor are you talking about? Because the material poor, it's not solved, don't get me wrong, it's not solved, but it is largely solved and increasingly solved. But there are all of these psychological problems that have come into place, right? So Adam Smith and Hume, they both insist that a fundamental feature of commercial life is mobility. Smith explicitly says that in commercial societies, the family will weaken and loyalty to place will weaken. Right? And of course, what happens when that happens is that our psychology suffers. Right? And so it's very interesting that when Rosling, right, so Rosling does this sort of axis thing, right, and so he says you've got wealth and you've got health, right? So global health is improving, right? Initially, 1810, everyone's below 40 years. Everyone dies before 40. Industrial Revolution comes along, David Hume comes along, and up it goes, right, and now we're into, the early 80s, right? And now not all countries are there, right? But as he puts it, the arrow goes only one direction. Everyone can make it to the other corner. But of course, right, he's just tracking health and wealth, right? There's nothing there about happiness, psychological adjustments, good marriages, good family, good sexuality. I mean, no, that's not, you know, that's not getting tracked there, right? So the idea would be, I think from Francis, the idea is that Hume has in some sense abandoned actually what matters most, right? The poverty we're speaking about here is the poverty that Pope Benedict tried to understand sort of metaphysically as the problem of isolation.
So, I mean, this kind of... this is a bleak situation in a lot of ways, and I'm reminded of just looking at the history of the church, especially like Benedict, St. Benedict, the original,
mm-hmm.
And the renewal of culture that happened through
yes.
small communities.
Yeah.
It's always small groups that change culture, and it's the opposite of vanity, because it takes a humility. I'm just going to change the people, influence the people around me,
right.
and the stability of place, too.
Right.
And I was just wondering if you could say anything about, I mean, if the estate, the idea of the estate, could be actualized even in an urban setting, in the sense of I think often Catholic young people, we feel like we can't do the things that we really value
mm-hmm.
because we feel like we need more money to support our families, but really we don't because we already have more money than our predecessors.
Mm-hmm.
But and also just looking at the new ecclesial movement and mm. how they've brought up this sense of committed community.
Yeah.
Like a couple of families living together and sharing
right.
life and creating
right.
culture.
Right, right. Yeah, well, look, I think you're right about this, right? The key somehow is to find this model of the estate that can reside in our cities, right? There is a massive migration globally going on as populations move into the cities. Now, armies, when they train for combat, they almost only exclusively train for urban combat, because that's where the people are. And they know when this next happens, this is the conditions, right? So it seems to me, now maybe this is reversible in some way. I mean, Cuccinelli is clearly setting his putting his money, right, in this idea that he has, that this, we can return to the village. But I think this is very interesting what you're saying, right, to find ways to resolve the problem of material poverty without falling into the isolation problem, right? So now there are various companies, right, that I think are trying this in some intriguing ways, right? So like, here's a company I'm sure you all have heard of, probably some of you wear this clothing, Patagonia. It's a kind of a outdoors lifestyle luxury brand. So you know, this is owned by one man, and he has established a policy where they are going to cut back on sales of new clothing. And how they're going to do this? Because they're going to rehab the old clothing, right? So he's setting up structures in the company to hire seamstresses who will mend your damaged clothing. So in other words, right, just as you see in Cuccinelli's video, you see these women working with their hands. So now, inside, you know, major fashion label, Patagonia, you have this. He's also established a website where people who no longer want their Patagonia can put it up on the website to sell it on a kind of an eBay model, right, to people who do want it, right? Another example, Ferrari Motor Cars, right? They're cutting back production, and they're building a platform whereby you can rehab your old Ferrari. You know, now those things cost millions of dollars, an old Ferrari, okay. Right, but the point is, right, there are these companies who are cutting back on the new and returning to a motif of craft, of estate, and I think this is very important, right, a different pace of life, right? So I think you're absolutely correct. There are, I think, spiritual movements within the church that have this idea, and I think happily there are also significant companies that are moving in this direction as well.
Can you say a little more about the estate? I mean, you're talking faith communities or anarcho-syndicalism.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I think the anarchism is probably under theorized in the church, right? So I get this idea from Max Scheler. And Max Scheler wrote a very beautiful work called Love in the 20th Century. So Max Scheler was a student of Husserl, the great founder of phenomenology. But Scheler died just at the moment that Martin Heidegger, who's by far the most important 20th century philosopher in Europe, came on the scene, right? So Heidegger kind of pushed Scheler off his perch. But Pope John Paul II wrote his early books on Max Scheler. So Scheler is very important in the development of Catholic personalism. So he writes this essay in 1919 called Christian Love in the 20th Century. And he's reflecting on the First World War. And he argues that the First World War was a commercial war. It was the big industrial powers flexing their muscle. And he says, well, okay, how do we escape that trauma in the future? And he talks about the estates. And he says the estates will have a few qualities. It will be an inheritance, or will establish a legacy. So Cuccinelli's a self-made man. But one can certainly imagine, and so is the guy from Patagonia, right? But one can imagine inheritances, and I'll give you an example in a second. It will have stability in a local place. The work that goes on will exhibit primarily love of the work, secondarily a concern for gross earnings, and only thirdly and lastly, profit. Okay? And I can give some more examples about this. So these are some of the, okay? So if I could just, yeah, maybe I could just, what time do we stop? Is it six?
It's a little after, but no, just six.
Okay.
Keep on going.
Okay.
People can feel free if they have, you know.
Okay, well, let me give you this example.
And so on, but, you know, right now
okay.
They're all enjoying what's going on.
Okay, let me give you this example, right? And this will test your intuition, okay? And this is a true story, right? It's sort of about me, sort of. Right? But really, it's about my father and another man who's a father, okay? So when I was young, my best friend was somebody called David Carr. And his father, unsurprisingly, was called David Carr. Right? I'm Graham McAleer, and you can guess my father's name?
Graham McAleer.
Right, so this is really about Big David and Big Graham, right, the story. So David and I had it in mind that when we left school, we would go to university, and we're only going to go to university in one place. We're going to go to London. We were going to go to the city. We were going to go to the place of David Hume, right? Because we lived in a little village in the countryside, a sheep farming country outside of Liverpool. And one day my dad comes back from the village and he says, you know, I've just been talking to David, Big David, and he says, David's not going to go to college. And I said, no, it's not possible. Like, we've got our plans, you know, we've sorted out, we're going. And he goes, no, he's not going to allow him to go. Here's what you need to know about Big David. Big David ran the local jewelry shop. And that shop had been in his family for about four generations. In England, Catholics were only permitted to worship openly after 1856. And our village church was built at that time. And when you go through the main, when you're going up to the main doors, there are these like gargoyles, right, looking down at you, right? And they are actually the faces of David Carr's like great, great, great grandparents. Right? Because they paid for the church, right? And so here's what David's father said to my dad. He said, look, Graham, you've got nothing to give your son. My dad was a clothes salesman, right? Traveled around the country selling clothes. He said, look, you've got nothing to give him. He's got to go to the city and try and do something for himself. But he said, look, I can give David everything somebody would want by going to college. I can give him a beautiful car, a great job, he'll inherit my business, can have a nice wife, nice kids. And David sometimes calls me up, right? And he always calls me up in the same way, right? He loves going on safaris. So he's always calling me up, he's going like, hey, what are you doing, Graham? I'm like, I'm working, David. And he's like, well, I'm in Kenya, the lions are great and all this, right? So it was true what David Senior said. I can give David everything that somebody wants by going to college. And here's what he said. He said, I cannot allow David to leave the village because he might never come back. And therefore, I would be a bad father if I allowed him to go. I wonder what your intuitions are on that. What are your intuitions? Do you think David was a good father? David Senior was a good father?
I don't know if you can say good or bad.
Why?
Himself. He was doing what was traditional.
Yes.
The son in the family business.
Yes. Okay. Is there anybody who thinks that was an unfair constraining of the longings of David or something like that?
Just a comment, there's a lot of Midwest farmers who pray for a young David.
David was a dutiful son. You know, he said, no, my father, you know, said, I shouldn't do it, so I'm not going to do it. Right? And, you know, as I say, you know, David's on safari right now. Trust me.
The only thing is, in something like that I would say to David's father is that university experience is not training for a job. To be an educated person.
Yeah, right. And I think that's certainly like a very good attitude, right? The worry I think that David Senior had was that the allure of the city, right, would open up visions to David, right, of a life quite different from the life of the village and being the village jeweler, right? So here's the thing, right? That example is, I think, what Max Shaler is talking about. In terms of an inheritance of an estate. Right? It's something one is going to find oneself placed in. It's going to curtail one's sense of competition, one's sense of vanity. Right? I mean, David's not growing the business.
right? He's just going to hand it on to his own son or sons, right? He's got a couple of kids, right? He's not like trying to become the next great jewel. He's not trying to become Tiffany's or something like that, right? It remains what it was when he received it. And I think that that idea is at the heart of Shayla's idea as well.
I like that story.
Thank you.
And I just wonder, if we were to move in that direction, mm-hmm. how do we prevent what's happened in the past of people trying to break off the shackles of that traditional roles? How do we prevent, you know, the pendulum from swinging the other way again and having to relearn all the stuff that we're learning now?
Well, that's okay. Look, it's a great, great point, right? I mean, right? How do we? Well, first we've got to identify the positive gains, right? And look, I think we've got to say with Hume that he was partly right, okay, about industrialization. I mean, you know, you and I love TV shows like Game of Thrones. We love the fact we're on our iPads watching it. You know, I mean, this is a very, very rich, stimulating, in many ways, highly intellectualized world, right? Okay, so how do we preserve and... So that's why I show you this Cuccinelli, right? Because it's, you know, what that guy is selling costs... The sweaters that guy makes cost $2,000. Right? So it's not that... So in other words, right, as he says it, right, it's not that there's... We don't want to be... We do not want to set our face against the beautiful. Right? This surely would be a mistake. But we don't want to collapse into vanity. Now, Aquinas gives us, I think, a kind of a normative structure. He says, we maybe can't get into it all, but let me just give the three basic ideas, right, that he's got. He says that beautiful things should be celebrated by offering them up to God. Cuccinelli, I think, right? There is this, clearly a very strong religious element to him. Right, he quotes St. Francis, etc. They should be celebrated so that others imitate them and thereby are enhanced, their lives are bettered. So think about the Catholic principle of subsidiarity, right? Enhancement. And that they reconfirm a person in virtue. Right. That so, and then he's got this analysis, right, where he gives these sort of leading characteristics of things that are sort of contrary to virtue. Okay, so I think what we've got to do is hang on to Shayla's idea. We've got to mix it somehow with Aquinas' normative structure, so that we can have beauty without collapsing into vanity. Now, I think that this is actually ongoing in the culture, right? I'll now speak maybe to some of the younger people. You've probably heard of this singer from New Zealand, Lorde. Yeah? So, you know the song, right? The song that she's most famous for is called We Will Never Be Royals. Well, if you... I mean, I suppose we could get it up, actually. actually, could you... And then it would be done. This is actually, I think, a very, very interesting pop video. Okay? Oh, yeah, we want to... if we can't get it, it's okay.
Just the lyrics.
Do you have the video?
There you go.
No, not the lyrics, we want the video. Is this the video?
No,
yeah, the second one. The top one?
That one.
Okay.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, no. Just look at the graphics as you listen to the words.
I've never seen a diamond in the flesh. I cut my teeth on a wedding ring in the moonlight.
So I think what's really fascinating about that song and the visuals, right, is that it is not about vanity, right? So the point is, she says every song is about the Maybach limousine, it's about the diamonds, it's about having an island, it's about having a tiger on a leash, right? And she says, our dreams are different than those, right? We do not share your love affair. So here is a woman, you know, she's 17 years of age, and yet she is sort of channeling an idea that this world of vanity is strangely sterile or strangely corrupting. And I think the other thing, right, that really strikes you when you look at that video is that the only way to describe her is chaste. Right? Unlike other pop stars, right, you only ever see her from the chest up. She is in a monochromatic color plate, white, a little bit of silver, right? You never see her body, right? It's just focused on a simplicity, right? There's something very Spartan about everything that you see. And even, right, the young men, right, those are young men from her high school, right, who are in the video, right? And you see their, you know, their acne and everything, right? I mean, it's very interesting, right, that she's saying, you know, when she says she wants to be a queen, right, what she of course means is, right, I want to be the queen of your heart, right? Not a queen as in a big limousine, right? So I think there is something in the culture that is yearning for this return to something like the sensibility of Shayla. I'm going to stop at that. Thank you.
Lots of food for thought. Would you like to go out to dinner?
Okay, well, tell me the
options. Here they are. There's a reporter who should see. There's an Italian.